position is so fierce and so almost crazed in their rage at Trump that they're willing to do almost anything daily to try to destroy him. I believe that there are forces afoot, and it's not just the left. It's not just the Democrats. I think that they're only one finger on a hand that want to stop Trump. They want to impeach Trump. They want to try to not only destroy Trump as a person for vindictive reasons, but they want to snuff out that which he stands for and that which he is doing. What is it in a nutshell that Trump is doing that has the establishment so concerned and so tied up in knots? I think that it was best described by chief advisor and strategist Steve Bannon at the CPAC convention when he said that the Trump administration seeks nothing less than the deconstruction of the administrative state. And this is an extraordinary effort because the administrative state is something by which governing powers have been transferred from elected officials who operate with a limited grant of power under the Constitution to unelected bureaucracies, unelected officials like judges, as we just saw with this travel ban stoppage, unelected agencies on a domestic and international level, even on the state level and local level, where you have these appointed officials or these bureaucrats making decisions over the most intimate and intricate parts of our lives. We have frittered away our freedoms. We have frittered away, in the real sense, our ability to govern ourselves. And Donald Trump challenges that. You have to check out his inaugural speech. It's incredible. It's something that, by conventional meaning, every school child should learn and read and memorize. He lays it out plain. He wants to return power to the people. He wants to take power away from the elite class that is unelected and unaccountable and return it to the very people whose ancestors fought a war for that, which is known as the American Revolution, as they sought to return power to the people, powers that had been usurped by the British monarch. And naturally, Trump is coming into fierce resistance. I would just, before I get into the main topic of today, which is my latest column submitted to Newsmax on the Trump travel ban and the Constitution, I want to just give an example, and that is this disaster of a couple of days ago regarding Rachel Maddow, who went out with an announcement that she finally has the goods on Donald Trump. Aha! We're finally going to take him down, right? And believe me, she's just, as I say, only a figurehead in this effort. They want to take Trump out of office. I'm not kidding. They want him impeached. I wouldn't be surprised if his life isn't in danger. Look at this. This rapper actually made a video with somebody shooting him. You want to talk about ugly? I mean, that wouldn't have happened with any other president. That's threatening. That guy should be charged. I mean, that's a crime, right? I mean, there's a law against threatening the president of the United States. But he won't be, because Donald Trump doesn't do it that way. But the Rachel Maddow situation is that she is, I think, so deranged with Trump hatred. And I don't know if she's a winning participant in this movement to take him down. She may be. I have no idea. But so absolutely hateful and so loathing of Trump that she decided to run this story with the release of two pages of Donald Trump's tax returns. Now, it's illegal for someone to obtain another person's tax returns. That's a big, big no-no. I mean, Richard M. Nixon basically had to resign because he looked at someone's tax returns, let alone make it public. Well, anyway, she got possession of this tax return. She did nothing illegal. I mean, she can read, once it's out there, she can read it. The ethics of it stinks. You know, you'd think that there'd be some propriety. But putting that aside, again, we're talking Trump haters. She got the document. Someone claims it was dropped into their mailbox, which I think is pretty fishy. And she announces that she has the goods on Trump. Then everybody tunes in. I don't know if she was doing it because just this blind hatred of Trump or if it's because she was trying to boost her ratings, which is certainly possible. I mean, this was a meme. You know, it became viral, all of that. But she gets on the air and suddenly people begin to realize as she launches into the usual long-winded kind of diatribe, and I'm not criticizing her for that. I do the same thing. But, you know, it becomes pretty apparent quickly that she doesn't have anything. She doesn't have the goods. You know, she's launching into this whole nutty left-wing conspiracy theories and some Russian oligarch landed at an airport at the same time as Donald Trump's plane landed. And, you know, it's like, it reminds me of like the worst side of the 1950s when someone would say, did you know that so-and-so was seen in a hotel room with a communist or with a mafia member? Oh, you know, real, real ugly, you know, guilt by association, you know, theories. Then she takes a break and comes back and finally reveals what she has. And that is two pages of Donald Trump's tax returns of 2005, which indicate that he made $150 million and that he had paid $38 million in taxes, right? That's a higher tax rate than Barack Obama paid, Hillary Clinton paid, you know, people at her network paid, you know, at Comcast or wherever they are. And that he made money, right? And it basically made him look good, okay? I mean, the accusation during the campaign was, well, Trump really isn't that rich. He didn't really make this money. He doesn't make anything. Well, this proved that wrong. And also that Trump pays very little taxes, if any. I mean, Hillary Clinton actually said during the debate that Trump probably pays no taxes, which proved that wrong. He paid $38 million. And basically, the whole thing made him look good. Now, the rumor is out there, and she looked like a horse's you-know-what. I mean, it was ridiculous, right? Her integrity is now up to serious question that she would do this. But the rumor out there now is that Trump himself, one of his people, released the tax returns to someone who eventually made sure it ended up in Rachel Maddow's hands. Well, if that's true, I think that's hysterical, actually. I mean, that's Donald Trump, once again, sliming his enemies, right? Making fools out of them, you know, exposing them. Which, by the way, it's his right to release his tax returns anytime he wants. But it's similar to a situation that happened during the campaign, right after the Billy Bush tape, when Trump was at a low point and there were rumors that he was going to drop out. Well, what he did was he called a press conference to make a major announcement, right? The media was panting. Oh my God, Trump is, you know, they announced we have a big announcement coming from the Trump campaign. And they rush into the National Press Club to cover this. And they show up and there's a long table, and sitting at that table are women who had been raped and sexually molested by Bill Clinton, and they were ready to be interviewed. And the media had egg on its face because they had to interview them since they had already announced that they were going to be there. And Trump got the last laugh on that. So if Trump did that with this case, I think that that's amazing, actually. I mean, to me, that's quite adept in terms of media, you know, ability. Let's just put it that way. Let me just see if I can do an announcement here. Yep,
it
there we go.
It may be hard to believe, but people just like you are already saving money. FeedThePig.org makes it easy. Their simple savings plan teaches you how to start saving without going overboard. So you don't need to ditch the car and start rollerblading to work.
I look ridiculous.
You look ridiculous!
You don't need to start foraging wild berries.
I was skeptical, but these are actually pretty good.
You don't need to sell your organs on the black market.
Lie back. This is gonna hurt.
Yeah, that hurts.
You don't need to rent out your apartment to drifters.
I made a fire with the wood in your bedroom.
That's my dresser!
And your closet door.
You just need an internet connection. Don't get left behind. Start your personal savings plan with the tips and tools on feedthepig.org. That way, you don't need to sell all your belongings and live in a commune.
These dungarees belong to all of us now, Tom.
Brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs and the Ad Council.
Driving has a rhythm all its own. Don't wreck it with a text. Before you get behind the wheel, silence your phone. Or better yet, designate a texter. For more text-free driving tips, visit stoptextstopwrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Dear John, I was hoping it wouldn't come to this, but you've left me no choice. I'm leaving. Uncontrolled high blood pressure is really serious, and lately you seem to really not care. I've been there for you since day one, and I know you think I'm gonna keep ticking. But no, my friend, I can quit whenever I want. Why can't we get back to the good times? When we were more active and ate more healthy foods, and you checked on me every once in a while. Is that too much to ask? I don't want to leave, but unless you stop ignoring me, what else am I supposed to do? Remember, when I quit, you quit. Sincerely, your heart.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. Doing the minimum to control your high blood pressure isn't doing enough. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. Check, change, control. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
And we are back. You're welcome to join the program. WMFO, 91.5 AM. Tufts University, Medford, Somerville, 855-915-9636 is the number. 855-915-9636. As I continue to try to finagle this YouTube business, I'm not quite adept at getting it done, but there it is. So I talked about the Rachel Maddow fraud situation, but that's something else. I want to get into now the main crux of what I wanted to bring to the table today and what I promoted the program as getting into, and that is the overturning of the Trump travel ban. Apparently, U.S. District Judge Derek Watson from Florida, from Hawaii, who is now being joined by, I believe, one, if not two, other federal judges in jurisdictions, they have put a temporary stay on President Trump's executive order that would have placed a temporary travel ban on immigrants and a reduction of travel permits from a list of six predominantly Muslim nations. Now, let's put aside the national security question about this for a minute, and that is that these nations on this list indisputably and documentedly and harbor enemies of America. They harbor enemy combatants. They harbor terrorists. They harbor people who have declared war against the United States and indeed who are carrying out acts of war against the United States, American citizens, American property all over the world and in this country, and have been doing so for many decades. That's indisputable. That was acknowledged by President Obama. That's been acknowledged by our national security apparatus. That's not up to question. Now, in some cases, these nations are not necessarily formally harboring the terrorists. They're failed states. They've lost control of their own sovereignty, their own system, and thus terrorists are there, like in Afghanistan, for example. But either way, they are responsible for what happens from their territory. That was something that was established by the Bush administration. It's known as the Bush Doctrine, which was developed after the attack of September 11th, 2001. And thus, they were put on a list of nations to be concerned about, at least, by President Obama. Well, President Trump has taken it the next step, and he has sought a temporary ban on people from those countries entering into the United States until we can figure out whether or not those who are coming have an affiliation with the organizations that are at war with the United States. And when I say at war, I don't think anyone would argue with me that that means war. They're killing Americans, and they're trying to kill Americans inside this country. I don't think that's a matter of controversy. I think that's understood. But putting aside the fact that this is the motivation of the president to put these nations on this list, and putting aside whether or not it's a good idea from a national security standpoint, it may be, it may not be, okay? It gets to a more fundamental question. It gets to a constitutional question. And that constitutional question is whether or not it is appropriate, whether it is lawful for our government, as in this case the executive branch, to regulate the immigration of peoples in such a manner. Now, the fundamental question, that Judge Watson, who made the ruling in Hawaii, was agreed with a group of left-wing lawyers who argued that it was unconstitutional for the United States to ban Muslims from entering the country, as such a ban, they argued, constituted religious discrimination. Specifically, the ban on Muslim immigrants, they argued, discriminated against the mother-in-law of a Hawaii Muslim cleric. And this is putting aside the fact that the mother-in-law in question could have been given a waiver if the congressman from Hawaii requested such a waiver from the State Department, which he probably would have received. Instead, they decided to open the floodgates to everybody because this one person wanted to enter the United States, who clearly was someone who was innocent, right? It reminds me of the Frank Amendment, which is another story for another day. Yet it still calls to a more fundamental question, and that is, does the United States, or for that matter, does any sovereign nation, today or in history, have a basic right to decide who enters the national home? International law and custom, as well as common law of nations, going all the way back to ancient times, indicate that such a right exists. And common sense tells us that this exists. Nations do have the right to decide who comes into the national home for the same reason that you, my listener, has the right to decide who enters your home. Right? Whether you own the place or whether you rent the place, however it happens, whether it's your dorm room, you have a legal right, a lawful right, to decide who enters your place. And once they're there, you have a right to decide how long they stay there. You can regulate your home. That your home is your space. If you want them to leave, they have to leave. You're absolutely on legal grounds in that assertion. Those are natural laws that are established and are supported by our system of justice. I mean, for example, if a person enters your home without permission, there's a law against that. It's called breaking and entering, right? If a person stays in your home without your permission, there's a law against that. Called trespassing. I mean, this is, you know, it's not up to question. I mean, we understand this. We understand it. It reflects not just our legal system, but it reflects our entire way of life, and not just in this country, but in any country. Even in communist countries, people had a say over who entered their space. It's natural to the human being to have a certain amount of sovereignty, if you will, over your immediate environment. Even if you're walking out on the street, if someone comes too close to you and they make you uncomfortable, you can charge them with assault. You know, I mean, this is something that even transcends human society. I mean, it exists in nature. This exists in the animal kingdom. I mean, have you ever tried to violate the space of a dog, for example? You'll get your hand bit, right? I mean, a bird doesn't let another bird violate its nest. A beaver doesn't let another animal violate its dam. A bee doesn't let a foreign bee enter its hive. I mean, these things are observable in nature. They are what define the being, the identity, the entity, the living being. Every living being has a space. That is just a fact of nature. There's no way around that. And so we establish governments to reflect nature. And in this case, we establish governments to make sure that we regulate who enters the national home as opposed to the private home or as opposed to our local community even. The national government gets to decide who enters the national home for whatever reason they choose. They reflect our values. If we don't want to have a person or a group enter our national home, then that is reflected in our government policy. We don't have to explain why. We don't need to justify it. In the same way that you don't have to justify why you don't want to have some person enter your private home. This is a natural right of sovereign nations. And thus, you have this particular judge saying no to our government when our government is simply exercising the same right that every government has exercised since the founding of the Republic, and that indeed every government in the world exercises, right? I mean, do you think you can enter into Cuba if you want to? Do you think you can enter into Zimbabwe anytime you want? I mean, every nation reserves the right. That's why we have sovereign nations. This is a basic. And as such, we can expect our government to act accordingly. And the idea, I don't know what that is, that a judge would decide to try to deny that right to our government is preposterous. It's just that simple. Anyway, you're welcome to join me, Chuck Morse, WMFO, 855-915-9636, 855-915-9636. Now, of course, there are moral questions about whether or not we should welcome in people to our national home. It was, for example, I would argue, immoral for our government to deny Jews the access, not the right, no one has a right, as I said, but to not welcome Jews in to this country who were fleeing from Nazi Germany. That was wrong. That was immoral. We ought to have done that. We ought to have encouraged other nations to do it. And it's actually a very shameful chapter in our history that not only did we not welcome Jews, or very, very few, but we actually pressured other nations to deny access to Jews. It's one of these strange chapters in history. I mean, we literally, at this Evian conference, which took place at Evian, France, within months of the outbreak of World War II, I think it was in mid-1939, which was headed by an American, and which was a reflection of American policy, we decided that the Jews would not be allowed to enter into various countries in the world, right? Now, Canada, for example, was headed by an anti-Semite, what was his name? Mackenzie King, who banned any Jew from entering Canada. Now, Canada is a vast, open country. They could have easily taken some Jews. One of the few countries that actually did let in Jews was England. They let in children who had been abandoned, whose parents had been, you know, murdered or taken away. The Kinder transports. At the same time, of course, Great Britain denied access by Jews to Palestine by actually putting ships off the coast to try to blockade Jewish boats trying to get in. Now, the Jews in question, these were people who were, their lives were immediately at risk. There's no question about that. Everyone knew that at the time. They were dealing at least with severe oppression and danger. These were people of means in many cases who had the resources. They would not be coming in as wards of the state. They would not be collecting welfare. They would be contributing to the societies that would welcome them in. They were loyal to the nation state that they lived in. Anti-Semitism aside, there's no evidence that Jews were anything but loyal to the nation they live in. That's actually part of Judaism. It's in the Talmud extensively that the Jew is to be loyal to the government. It goes back to the Roman times. And they had sponsors in the United States. They had people who were willing to sign a document. This is how immigration used to be done before the 1965 Immigration Act, which changed everything. That the new immigrant would have to have a sponsor, a person, a family, a company, someone who would sign an agreement saying that we'll take responsibility for this person for a number of years, usually 3 years, and we will take financial responsibility if necessary, and that we will help them acclimate and assimilate into the new country in any way we can. And then when they'd come here, they'd take a loyalty oath to the new constitution. They would promise to support that constitution, and they would then come. And these were people who wanted to become Americans. They were urgently, you know, loyal to America. There was no question about that. Now, I'm not suggesting there weren't a few communists who might have slipped into the cracks. Yes, that is a problem. But of course, back then, that wasn't seen as anything wrong anyway, putting that aside. The Jews fleeing from Nazi Germany made the case that they ought to be granted refugee status. And I think that this country has been very generous in that way. The country doesn't have to welcome refugees. There's nothing in the Constitution, as I said, that would force us to do it. But we should do it in that case, or should have done it, for moral reasons. Likewise, in the 1970s, when the communists took over Vietnam, our southern ally, and we had hundreds of thousands of people getting on rickety boats with shark-infested waters to try to escape that miserable left-wing progressive hellhole. We welcomed them into this country by the hundreds of thousands, and they were great people. It was an extraordinarily loyal immigrant group, highly skilled people, people who were willing to work. We welcomed them into this country, and we should have. We welcome into this country millions of people from Mexico and Latin America, who will likewise are hardworking people who want to contribute to this country because that's good policy. Now, whether we should do it, we should make a way to do it legally. I agree with President Trump about that. But, and there should be a pathway to make sure that people are legal so we know who they are. But nevertheless, we're fairly liberal and always have been with regard to Latin American immigration. In fact, 1925 Immigration Act, which restricted immigration from certain countries, signed by Calvin Coolidge, placed no restrictions on Latin America. We also had special refugee status rights to Cubans trying to flee from that miserable left-wing jackboot of a regime that was crushing the necks of innocent people who were groaning under the pain and suffering of that left-wing progressive country, right? We welcomed them in until, of course, Barack Obama, as one of his last miserable, feckless acts as president of the United States, one of his last treasonous, you know, despicable orders, decided to rescind that right and leave those poor Cuban people to have to suffer under the left-wing tyranny of that horrible regime. So thus, they no longer would be able to come here. And if they did, they would be returned. Just like what Roosevelt did to the ship Liberty. He returned Jews to Nazi Germany. It's not that bad, but, you know, I hope you get my point. The point is that our president, whether we like it or not, has the right to regulate who enters the country. And I would suggest that in the case of Muslim immigration, it's a serious subject that ought to be discussed dispassionately, without hyperbole, without accusation, because it's one of those things that that really could change the dynamic of our society. You know, I think that there are, each of these cases are different. The charge by this federal judge that Donald Trump and that his administration is animated by an anti-Muslim feeling. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's not relevant. They have a right to do that, just like Franklin Roosevelt, unfortunately, had the right to be driven by anti-Semitism, which he was, in his denial to Jews. That's just, I mean, it's unfortunately, it's a right of nations. But the question with Muslims is not anti, you know, it's not like a religious, it's not a matter of religion. Whereas Judaism, or for that matter, we could go back to the 19th century, Catholicism, the arrival of Irish immigrants, which was controversial in the 1840s. The question was, well, are these people going to be loyal Americans? Are they going to assimilate into the United States? Are they going to contribute to America? And there were conspiracy theories back then that they would not, which were lies. It was just not true. There was no evidence of it. They did assimilate, and they did become loyal Americans. I would suggest that with Islam, it is not so easily answered. Now, first of all, the Jews had nowhere to go. I mean, there was no Jewish state at that time. Israel was not yet independent. Whereas in the case of Muslims, they have vast states all the way stretching from, I think that their nation states which are predominantly Muslim, stretch across about a quarter of the surface of this world. They go all the way from the Atlantic to the South Pacific. They go all the way from the borders of Siberia to the very darkest, deepest parts of Asia and Africa. Many of these states are oil rich or mineral rich. They've got great natural resources. They have huge territories. They've got vast lands, many of them underpopulated. These are nations that could easily absorb fellow Muslims and do so in a way that is quite comfortable. I mean, we're talking about some of the richest societies in the world here. Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, right? I mean, these are nations that can handle immigration from one Islamic nation to another. Or they can help with Islamic nations like Syria that have basically become failed states and that are just in horrible suffering. And we can help them do that. In fact, that is the Trump policy, to help Syrians stay in Syria by helping them develop safe zones. I think a very well articulated and reasonable policy. But is it really necessary for us, or for that matter, Europe or the non-Muslim world, to have to swing open the doors because of the suffering in Muslim countries. And again, these are sovereign nations to Muslims who are then going to come to non-Muslim countries and pose a problem or a question with regard to whether or not they're going to export the same system and the same problems that led them to leave their countries in the first place. And that's a question that ought to be answered before any nation, let alone ours, swings open said floodgates. You know, I mean, it's just, it's a basic. It's something that ought to be understood. And I would suggest that there are problems associated with massive Muslim migration. It's not because, first of all, Islam is not a race, so it's not a racial question. Muslims are of all races. In fact, if you take a look at the Council on American Islamic Relations, a group that has affiliations with the Muslim Brotherhood, according to the Holy Land case, they are whites, you know, like Abraham Hooper, he's Irish, right? I mean, they're people who converted to Islam. So it's nothing to do with race. I don't think, you know, Islam is, Arabs are white. I mean, so if they have a race, it's probably Caucasian more than anything. And it really has nothing ultimately to do with religion either, per se. It has to do with Islam as an ideology that seeks to destroy nation states around it and to create a world government. And that, of course, gets to why Islam finds resonance, let's just put it that way, with leftism in the United States and around the world. I would suggest that, first of all, leftism, communism, whatever you want to call it, it goes by different names, is not something that simply popped up out of nowhere. It wasn't something that emerged out of the fecund imagination of Karl Marx in the 1840s when he published the Communist Manifesto either. It's something that goes way back. It's something that actually goes to the very beginning of time. I mean, Whitaker Chambers, the author of Witness, who himself was a communist in the United States, he refers to communism as the world's second oldest religion. It is the worship of man as opposed to God. And he posed the question, our choice in this lifetime and in every generation is, do we choose God or do we choose man? Are we going to be God-based or are we going to be secular man-based, atheistic? And his contention is that if we choose God, then we're recognizing that there are immutable truths that have emanated from a divine force or source that are not corruptible or manipulable by the hand of man. As opposed to the socialistic construct, which is that all rights and all reality ultimately comes from man. That some enlightened group of people can mold and shape reality to fit their own image, right? And this is why they separate science from faith, because they claim that science is some kind of objective empirical truth, when in fact science wouldn't be science without the supernatural. You know, but they want to pretend that that doesn't happen, that somehow this is all explainable by material means. Anyway, I'm getting a little off track here. The point is that Islam appeals to the left because Islam is an ideology, and it's a communistic ideology. My point being that communism goes back long before Marx. You know, you could say that in many ways, Mohammed was a communist. I just did a brief YouTube where I happen to be Jewish, and I was in synagogue for Purim reading the Megillah, which is the story of Esther and Mordechai and how they overcame the evil ruler Haman in ancient Persia, who had hatched a plot to slaughter all the Jews of Persia. And I made the point that Haman could be described as the world's first communist dictator, and that his edict was the world's first communist social experiment. He wanted to redistribute the wealth. He wanted to take it away from the millionaires and the billionaires, as Elizabeth Warren might say. And he wanted to then give the wealth to others who wanted it because they just wanted it. You know, he appealed to the worst side of human nature, which is what leftism does. This idea that somehow if your neighbor has more than you have, you have a right to it. You want to stop them because it rises in you your own sense of jealousy and inadequacy and fear and, low self-esteem. And you're going to feel better. You can sleep better if you somehow are able to take it away from them. And you're entitled to it. And then when somebody comes along and claims that they're going to use the power of the state to do that, you vote for them. You support them, even if you do it quietly, because they're appealing to that darker side of your human nature. That's the appeal of socialism, that everybody has to be, quote, equal, and that if someone has more than you have a right to it just because you want it, not because you did anything, not because you accomplished anything. From each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. You don't have to have ability. You just have to have need. And if you have need, you have a right to someone else's fruit of their abilities, however they achieved it. Well, that's the communist appeal, and that was the appeal that Haman, the prime minister, the dictator, if you will, who operated under the king Ahasuerus, who was married to Esther, the Jewess, that he sent out an edict to confiscate the Jewish property and kill all the Jews of Persia because one Jew, that being Esther's uncle Mordechai, refused to bow when he walked through the court. That's because Mordechai didn't bow to a king. Mordechai only bowed to God, only sought saw that his rights emanated from a creator of the universe, not from the state. And by the way, that was the same appeal that was expressed by Jesus of Nazareth, who refused to accept the edict of the Roman government as represented by Pontius Pilate. When Pontius Pilate said to him, "Who do you answer to?" And he said, "I answer to an authority outside of this room. I answer to a greater authority, God." And it was shortly after that that Jesus was crucified because he stood up to the state, just like Mordechai and Esther, except in the case of Mordechai and Esther, they did it through a subterfuge. I mean, they tricked Ahasuerus into siding with them. It wasn't quite as open. With Jesus, he stepped right out there in the middle and did it, which is why he is so revered by freedom-loving people all over the world, Christian and non, I would add. Well, anyways, Haman's attempt to redistribute the wealth was undone in that story, and I have a YouTube up on that. If you want to view it, you can go to my YouTube site, Chuck Morse on YouTube. Well, you know, the Islamic idea is something quite similar. They don't recognize private ownership of property. They don't recognize individual rights. Everything is under Sharia law, which is a kind of like a communistic control over every aspect of the life of the individual and the use of the state to effect that control. It's not just a suggestion. These are edicts. These are backed by the authoritarian state. And authoritarianism can only come from the state. You know, I mean, it's not comparable, for example, to Jewish halacha, Jewish law, or for that matter, Catholic law, or what's called canon law, because those are not backed by the state. Those are voluntary. No one has to be Catholic. No one has to be Jewish. You can enter into those that way of life at your will, and when you're in it, you don't have to do any of it. You may not be accepted by them if you don't, but the point is, it's a voluntary relationship. In the case of Judaism, it is a covenant between God and the Jewish people, and the Jewish people are then free to either live by the covenant or not. Now, in biblical times, they'd be punished if they didn't, but nevertheless, it was an act of free will. There was no, you know, forcible state control. There was no government that forced people to be kosher or anything else. Likewise with Christianity. Christianity is a personal relationship between the believer and God through the intercession of Jesus Christ. That's a private personal relationship. There's no force involved. Now, that doesn't mean that Christians and Jews have not, from time to time, engaged in force. They have, and there are some terrible examples of it in history. I would only point out, however, that when they did, they were acting contrary to their teachings of their faiths, that these were exceptions and not the rule, and that they were relatively few instances in comparison to more authoritarian faiths. Islam, on the other hand, shares with communism this idea that the power and the levers of state can be used to enforce, in the case of Islam, it's Sharia law. In the case of communism, it's collectivism. But that the state can be used to enforce these things, these experiments, if you will. Communism, they wrap it up in science. In Islam, they wrap it up in Allah. And by the way, in that sense, I actually believe that Islam is more moral than communism. And it's not as bad, frankly. At least they believe in a higher power. But either way, they find resonance in this belief that there needs to be a nanny state, a total state, the use of state in an authoritarian way to enforce laws. And the Islamic laws are not commensurable, frankly, to our democratic system, our democratic way of life. They don't recognize individual rights. They don't recognize the right of woman as equal to a man. Now, look, there's no easy way to say this. And I don't mean to offend anybody here, but we have to discuss this dispassionately. The fact is that women don't have the same rights as men in those countries. Now, in Judaism and Christianity, women do have equal rights to men. The Torah in the book of Genesis says that God created men and women, and it says that, men and women, in his image. So the man and the woman are equal. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't customs that create inequality. I don't deny that. And I think that for the most part, those have receded. But essentially, men and women are equal in Judaism and Christianity because we are all equal under God. We're images of God. Whereas in Islam, they're not. Okay? Now, that's just a fact. You can study the Quran and the Hadith and see that women are subservient to men. Women are property of men. They don't have rights. They derive their rights through their husband. And if they don't have a husband, it's through their father or their brother or some other male figure. And that as such, women can be and are abused in those countries. You know, a woman can be whipped. A husband can beat his wife under Islamic law. Polygamy is allowed. Clitorectomies are allowed. A woman manipulating the woman's sexual organs. Child brides. Muhammad had a wife that was 9 years old who he had intercourse with. I mean, the Quran and the Hadith are very explicit about that. Her name was Aisha. Honor killings. If a girl goes out publicly with a man who's not her father or brother, she could be killed and is killed. This isn't something that is just on the books. You know, I mean, since the influx of Muslim immigrants to this country, there has been an increase in these sorts of killings. And for reasons that are quite interesting, the New York Times, which is the left-leaning establishment mouthpiece, they don't report this. They'll report that there was a killing, and they'll report that a girl was killed by her father or her brother, but they won't report that she was that the family was Muslim. You know, they leave that out. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. How are you?
Fine. I want to make a point. Wait, I got to turn my radio off.
Please, thank you very much.
One second.
Yep, and by the way, the number here is 855-915-9636. Do you want to get in?
Are you still there?
I am. Yep.
Listen, you know what the saddest part of the whole election was?
What's that?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
The saddest part of the whole election was John McCain not running one more time, because the country was set up for any Republican to win that election. If John McCain ran one more time, he would have got the nomination and he would have got the presidency. That's the saddest part of the whole thing, in my opinion.
I'm not sure why you think so. I mean, Mitt Romney, John McCain, we could go back to Bob Dole. You know, these sort of establishment rhino Republicans, they were not winning. And I don't think that, I don't see any evidence that they would have started to win now.
Well, I said to everybody all through the election that I wish John McCain had tried one more time. And the fact that Donald Trump won proves my point. Any Republican would have won that election. And it's a shame that John McCain didn't run one more time. Now I'll get off the air because I loved listening to you.
Thank you. All right. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Take care. Let's see. 855-915-9636. If you'd like to get on the final segment of the show, Chuck Morse here at WMFO. Every Thursday, 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I think that, you know, we could look at the bigger question here, which is, what's the difference between John McCain and Hillary Clinton? What would be the difference between Bob Dole and Bill Clinton? What was the difference between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama? You know, I think it was the late Phyllis Schlafly, who I knew and who I interviewed many times and considered a friend, who wrote a book in 1965 called A Choice, Not an Echo. Well, those candidates were just echoes. I mean, they were part of this establishment. You know, they were just a little bit not quite as liberal. So we wouldn't slide into socialism as quickly with them. So I disagree with the caller here. I think that Donald Trump was different. I think that Donald Trump is actually conservative. And that's why the establishment, both the Democrats and the, you know, the kind of the establishment rhino Republicans, people like Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney, why they're just going berserk. Look at today. I mean, Trump's new budget is fantastic. He's defunding the National Public Radio. I mean, that's revolutionary. Who ever thought that we'd ever see that? You know, he is doing what he said he'd do. He is deconstructing, as Steve Bannon said, the administrative state. And it's not going to go down easy. And Steve Bannon also made the point at CPAC that every single day is going to be a fight. And that rather than fight Trump and rather than fight the movement that he has created, and it is a movement, and John McCain did not create any movements, neither did Mitt Romney, neither did any of these other guys. They were just your typical get-along, you know, me-too kind of Republicans in name only. Trump has started a movement, a real movement, and it's one that's going to reverberate for the next generation, I would argue. And by the way, I predict that a year from now, maybe 2 years from now, Donald Trump is going to pick up a lot of support amongst millennials, amongst, you know, students here at Tufts University who are now, you know, many of whom are locked into this hatred of Trump, that they're going to start to look at that. They're going to start wondering, what is that really about? And I think that there's going to be a period of questioning, and that this movement is going to peel off a number of people, especially as it becomes more successful. And it will become more successful. How you doing? Anyway, we have a few more minutes. You're welcome to join the final segment. I suppose I should mention as a sort of a shameless plug here that my books are available at Amazon.com. Just put my name in the server, Chuck Morse, and you'll see them come up. My column is available as well. And that's, let me just see if I can see a shoutcast here. I don't see that. Well, I don't know. How do I see shoutcast? It's, where is shoutcast? Shoutcast, there it is.
Yeah.
All right. Just curious. Oh, we've got 14 listeners, 56 bit rates. I don't know what a bit rate is. That's cool. So my books are available at Amazon.com. Just put my name in the server, Chuck Morse, Morse like Morse code, M-O-R-S-E, and you'll see about 15 nonfiction books come up. One of my latest is called Communism is Not Dead. And also my column, which is published by Newsmax, that is usually published on Tuesday. It's up on the website for several days, and that's under the opinion page at Newsmax.com. And so that's just a matter. I'm just mentioning these things as a public to let people know where they can get more information about me and the show. And of course, this program will be podcasted on iTunes, Chuck Morse Speaks, and the YouTube segment, which is just a small segment of the show, will be up on the YouTube page of Chuck Morse Speaks. So I'm becoming a king of all media, as Howard Stern would say. My daughter, who's a teenager, whose computers are her second language, she's helped me do a lot of this stuff, and so I'm now getting into all sorts of interesting alternative medias that were not available all that long ago. Anyway, so again, I want to thank you all for listening this afternoon, and I am now going to try to go to the, let me just see, because I need to learn this better, how to sign out. I think we go to... Well, I'm at Shoutcast right now, but let's just see. Spinatron. And how do I get to Rivendell? Right here? RD?
Yeah.
And RD is right here. And there we go. And where is RD? I don't see it.
It's on the left.
Up on the left right here?
And now, yep. There you go.
And where is it? Let's see. Oh, there it is. All right. So let me just... How do I start the music?
Just put on like a PSA.
PSA?
Hit
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone, and I shall return next week.
It may be hard to believe, but people just like you are already saving money. FeedThePig.org makes it easy. Their simple savings plan teaches you how to start saving without going overboard, so you don't need to ditch the car and start rollerblading to work.
I look ridiculous.
You look ridiculous!
You don't need to start foraging wild berries.
I was skeptical, but these are actually pretty good...
You don't need to sell your organs on the black market.
Lie back. This is gonna hurt.
Yeah, that hurts.
You don't need to rent out your apartment to drifters.
I made a fire with the wood in your bedroom.
That's my dresser!
And your closet door.
You just need an internet connection. Don't get left behind. Start your personal savings plan with the tips and tools on feedthepig.org. That way, you don't need to sell all your belongings and live in a commune.
These dungarees belong to all of us now, Tom.
Brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs and the Ad Council.